Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily and these days more than daily politics podcast. I'm Katie Balls and I'm joined by James Forsyth and Fraser Nelson, and we're at the Conservative Party conference. Though right now we're a 10-minute walk away because we're recording it at the charming, might be the wrong word, hotel that we're in.
Bijou. Without a fridge in the hotel room, imagine that.
Fraser has put his beers on a window shelf on a high-rise building. Anyway, for now, we have had our first full day yesterday of Conservative Party conference. Fairly eventful for several reasons. Some reasons not to do anything that happened in the conference hall. We have the allegations surrounding, made by the journalist Charlotte Edwards, that Boris Johnson touched her leg at a
spectator lunch, apparently.
Have you ever touched heard of such a thing? At spectator lunch, along with various fringes where comments were made on Brexit. Now, before we get to the allegations surrounding Boris Johnson, looking at what is happening with Brexit and the prospects of a deal, James, you were at the Arlene Foster fringe yesterday. Did you get a sense that the DUP were softening their red lines?
The only thing the DUP are compelled to consider, I think, is this time limit on the backstop. Arlene Foster was quite clear that she would not accept any regulatory checks between Northern Ireland and Great Britain that extended beyond agriculture. And there are already some ways in which the island of Ireland is treated as a single unit on agricultural matters. She also ruled out any kind of compromise on customs. Is there any idea that Northern Ireland could be in both the UK and EU customs territories? So I think a time limit on the backstop is the only option there then that the DUP would consider. But as Arlene Foster herself said, Leah Varadkar has repeatedly ruled that out. And I think one of the things that makes this difficult is, I think a time limit on the backstop would only be acceptable to Dublin if it came with some guarantees about what would happen at the end of that time limit. And the Arlene Foster position essentially doesn't give Dublin those guarantees. So, I think the chances of a deal definitely kind of receded a bit yesterday. And I think the other interesting thing about this conference is that I don't really think anyone expects the UK to leave on October 31st. I mean, in the kind of private conversations you have at conference, everyone thinks that we are looking at another extension, and the question is, who do leave voters, pin the responsibility for that extension on?
Fraser, are you also picking up the sense that perhaps a Brexit deal is not imminent? We're hearing that if there is going to be a Brexit deal in the next week or so, we'll have a sign of that because the EU leaders will need to know ahead of an EU Council summit.
Oh yes, and the Angela Merkel's 30-day deadline has come and gone. And the strange thing is that they keep repeating this 31st of October deadline time and time again.
Notably, it's not on the mugs.
Yes, when you get to conference, and I didn't see it on the mugs and other things, I thought, maybe they're backtracking. But no, the messaging is all very clear. Now, given that the 31st of October is just a month away, you do wonder what on earth they intend to do, what the strategy is. But nonetheless, I don't know, they're proceeding. I mean, it's strange. Sajid Javid this morning gave an interview to the Today programme where he hinted that he's found a way round the Benn Act. In other words, that's the act which forces the governments to extend EU membership. And there is talk of finding some kind of loophole. Mind you, as we speak, there are a whole bunch of Labour MPs and the new former Conservative allies gathering in the House of Commons to think of what laws to pass. So if there is a loophole in the Benn Act, then they can pass another one. I mean, there's all sorts of things that they can do now that Parliament's back.
James, is this about finding a loophole, or is this about the government looking as though they've done everything possible to try and not request an extension and avoid one, even if the loophole doesn't actually hold up?
Yeah, I think the point of it is finding a kind of semi-credible strategy that they can say, we've got this loophole, so we're not going to send the letter requesting the extension. Then it will end up in the courts, and the courts will order them to send the letter. And I think that the idea is that puts a kind of another layer between Boris Johnson and the letter, and shifts the blame in essentially for who is responsible for the extension in the eyes of Leave voters. I mean, I think if you think about it just for a second, which is a Supreme Court that decided unanimously what it decided last week about prorogation not being a proceeding in Parliament, that it was unlawful. If you consider their behaviour last week, if you consider that the government then attempted to circumvent the intention of the Benn Act, and this would be a much more explicit breach than the prorogation thing, which I think is a very debatable point, I think the courts would find very quickly against the government. But the point in a way is, from the government's point of view, if that's what happens, then it's the judges who are responsible for the extension, not Boris Johnson. I think this is
Yeah, and in those circumstances, do you think that, say, this went to the courts, the government lost again, another loss to add, Boris Johnson would send that letter or he would resign?
I think he doesn't want to resign. I think this is one of, I think there are some people in his government who are, can see the political attractions of the resignation strategy. You know, I cannot do this. I think he himself, and I think his answer on the Andrew Marr show yesterday indicated this, he himself doesn't want to resign.
But James, do you think he's changed his mind on this? Because a few weeks ago, you had been told that he was thinking of resigning.
I think that as number 10 has this effect on people, but very few prime ministers walk out of that door voluntarily, even if it's a tactical resignation. I think, you know, I think that is not something that he is attracted to, and it has become less attractive to him with the passage of time. I think in the initial, when they were initially hit by this piece of legislation, I think it really was, oh, I'd rather quit than do that. Mm. Now I think it's kind of, well, let's try and find a way around it. Let's cross that bridge when we come to it, kind of thing.
But the risk they now run is that they repeatedly talk about the 31st of October again and again and again. If they don't get out by then the Brexit Party voters will think, you see, Boris Johnson just can't deliver. And they'll be walking into the trap that I imagine is being set for them by the Rebel Alliance, which is to show that people, if you really want Brexit, don't trust the Tories to bring it, because they can't. And therefore, you split the Brexit vote between the Brexit Party and the right.
I mean, I think that is the scenario that we've heard before in terms of if they'd miss the extension. But one of the things I sense in the past week is that it almost just feels the narrative, and I don't think this is part of the, you know, the classic Dom strategy, which is all part of a meticulous plan, but the narrative does seem to be forming that everyone is out to get the government in terms of them delivering Brexit, and they're the ones pushing it. So I do sense that there is a view now amongst various figures in government that an extension is clearly far from ideal, but they could potentially wear it in a way that they couldn't have a few weeks ago if they look as though it has been completely forced on them by the establishment.
I think one of the things that gives them hope is, ironically, a Twitter post from Nigel Farage. Nigel Farage went on GMB and basically said Boris Johnson should, I can't remember, he said should resign. Yeah. I think he did say should resign.
He resigned immediately after the Supreme Court ruling.
Farage posted that up on Twitter, and as lots of cabinet ministers are very keen to point out to you, he was then deluged with responses from people who are normally his supporters saying, no, you're wrong, Boris is, you know, bat Boris, we've got to bat Boris, Boris is the only guy who can get Brexit done, kind of thing. And I think that's their hope. Their hope is that there is this sense, as Katie said, that there is a sense that there are all these forces ranged against Boris Johnson and Brexit, and he is Brexit's champion, and only by voting for him, I mean, which is what the kind of Tory message is going to be to those voters. And then I think the message to other voters essentially is going to be, let's just get this thing done and then we can move on, which is why the slogan of this conference is just get Brexit done, rather than kind of hear of a sun that uplands of our brilliant post-Brexit future. It's just get it done.
Now, moving to the other stories dominating the headlines, which is Boris Johnson and whether or not he has a woman problem. It links to two stories. We've had the Jennifer Nacurie story about the American businesswoman who received funds from the government for various things, and questions about Boris Johnson's role in that and his relationship. And then the latest story, as per the Sunday Times, is Charlotte Edwards, the journalist, saying that Boris Johnson had touched her upper thigh at a spectator lunch along with a woman on the other side. And Boris Johnson has taken the quite rare step of actually denying that, something that normally the approach to Boris Johnson on personal life issues is just to completely ignore it. Were you surprised by that, Fraser?
I'm not surprised by the actual allegation, insofar as there were all sorts of stories coming out of the Spectator 20, 25 years ago, where the lunches were sort of legendary. The magazine would go to press at midday on a Wednesday when there'd be a lunch, and those lunches basically wouldn't finish. There'd be talks of the guests falling asleep upstairs at 6, 7 o'clock in the evening, with a lunch still going on downstairs. But even in those days, there wasn't talk of hanky-panky at the lunches. There might have been plenty of misbehaviour in general, but not really befalling lunch guests. That said, I think that Boris Johnson is not a politician who poses as a living saint. If this had been, you know, John Major or something, it would have been a lot more damaging, because John Major was talking about back to basics, moral conservatism. Boris Johnson is many things, but he's not a hypocrite on this score. People know that he's had a very complicated personal life. They know he's had two marriages and various women he's fallen in love with. He hasn't really sought to conceal that, but nor does he seek to talk about it either. So I'm not sure how politically damaging this will be for him in the long run.
James, it's the most shocking thing that he has denied it.
I think the reason he's denied it is that he, in his own mind, draws this distinction between his romantic life and the idea that he is in some ways a kind of groper or guilty of sexual assault or you know, all these things. And that is why I think he's denied it, because I think his feeling is that this isn't did you sleep with this woman? This is, did you do something that I mean, I'm not a lawyer, but I suspect is probably a criminal offence. And I think that is why he has denied it, because he is, and I remember during the Me Too scandal, he was very much of the view that, you know, no one is making these allegations about him, because, you know, that's not, you know, he might, I'm trying to find a more decorous way
but
of saying this.
He's a bunker, but not a grouper.
That probably does sum up what he thinks.
Thank you, James. Thank you, Fraser. And we'll be back, presumably later today, with more on this podcast. And we also have our live Coffee House Shots recording tomorrow. And by tomorrow, I mean Tuesday. That's 1 to 2 p.m. at the Midland, I believe, in the Alexandra Suite. And we have a host of special guests. And I think we'll start to release the names on the podcast to come.
Not that we're still arranging it.
No, it's a very well organised event.